It's a wonderful thing to sing praises to God, is it not? If you can tell me something better, I'd be highly interested to know what that is. Sometimes people say to me, well, won't heaven be boring just singing to Jesus? Well, that's not all you'd be doing by a long way. Come and see me later if you want to know what else you'd be doing. But if you think it would be boring singing to Jesus forever, I'll tell you why we get that wrong. This is not to do the talk. It's because we forget that when the angels are in heaven, every time they catch a glimpse of the Lord, it's as if they see him for the very first time. Oh my. And fall down prostrate. You see, we think, well, you know, if they've been with them for all of eternity or best part of it, wouldn't they get bored? If you think like that, you don't know what Jesus is like. For them, every time is like the first time. And when you get to heaven, every time you see him will be like the first time. And you will just fall down and say, oh my, what's he like? Thank you to the worship group. I thought it was great this morning. I think you just hit the nail spot on. And thank you to Joe and Paul. Again, did very well. I never told them the topic, but the song fits spot on with the topic this morning. I had to go to the dentist on Wednesday. My dentist is over in New Brighton. It's a long story. And I don't really mind going. I've been going there for nearly 30 years. But I was stopped outside Walton Hospital at the lights for a couple of minutes. And I was looking across where the old maternity unit used to be. That's where I was born, 25, 28 years ago, something like that. I can't dream. But as I was sitting there, a man came staggering down the road. This is about 1 o'clock. Really drunk, in his 50s, very disheveled. It was obviously a way of life to him. And he sat on the wall opposite where I was parked up for a couple of minutes. And he had a bottle in his hand, and he was singing, and he was shouting at people. And I looked at him, and I thought for a few moments, you know, what led him to a life like that? Because nobody wakes up one morning and thinks, I'll wreck my life with alcohol. I'll wreck my life with drugs. I'll wreck my life by having a relationship with someone who isn't my wife. Nobody wakes up and decides, I'll wreck my life today. Nobody. It's always a series of incremental steps where somebody ends up with a wrecked life. And I looked at the guy and I thought, well, wow, but for God's grace, that's me on that wall with the bottle. It's you. And then the lights changed, and I had to go. And 50 minutes later, I'm coming towards the new tunnel. And if you've been through the tunnel recently, there's a billboard that's bigger than this whole center, like the whole thing. And there's a poster up from Scottish Widows. Have you seen it? Do you know what it says? It says, change your life in 1 hour. Have you seen it? I'm going to Google it this week and find out what it's about. But the phrase has stayed with me since last Wednesday. Change your life in 1 hour. I thought, isn't that interesting? Imagine if you could do that. Imagine if before this service is over, you could change your life in 1 hour. I wonder what you'd change. Really, seriously. I'm not talking about changing your conservatory or your car. I'm talking about your life. If before this service is over, you could change your life, I wonder what you'd change. I mean, anything, if you could change anything. Change your life in 1 hour. A few years ago, a friend of mine asked me to join him in a game of golf. Now, I'm not a golfer. I like football. But he asked me to join him in a game of golf at Kirby Golf Course. And I'd only ever played once before. And that was with a guy who was as bad as me. And we spent the best part of the day on Kirby Golf Course looking for lost balls. But this time I was going to play with someone who knew how to play. And he had all of the gear, the right equipment. So we got to Kirby Golf Course, which doesn't have flags, by the way. Everyone's pinched the flags. There's twigs in the hole with a Coke can on top. Really, there's no flags. There's a twig on top, with a Coke can. So, but anyway, my mate's got all this gear. My mate Jeff, who's going to come and preach here, he's probably listening this morning. He's got a church down in Worcester. That's where it was. So he's got all this expensive gear. He says, come and play. I said, Jeff, I don't really like golf. You know, I spend the best part of the day looking good. Come and play. He said, I'll teach you how to play. So we got on the first tee, and he gets all this gear out. And I thought, I'll watch and learn. It can't be that hard. You know, people on the telly make millions out of this. So on the first tee, my friend Jeff lined up the ball, and he took, I watched him look, you know, look how far the first green was. I watched him take a club out. He set himself on. I watched how he held the club, watched how he put his feet on the ground. Then he took a swing at this ball, and he hit this ball, and it took off like a missile. It was so fast, I couldn't see it. I genuinely couldn't track the flight of the ball. So I said, where did it go, Jeff? He said, it's on the green. Well, I peered in the distance. You know, it must have been 5 miles away. I said, really? He said, yeah, it's about 6 foot from the pin. The pin. I said, the twig. He said, well, all right, yes, it's 6 foot from the twig. Then he said, it's your turn. So I'm not stupid. I picked out the same club. We were using his clubs. So I picked out the same club. I set my feet at the same stance as Jeff. I swung the club exactly as he did, and I hit the ball with all the strength I mustered. I sliced the ball, and it took off at a 90-degree angle. It was astounding. I didn't think a golf ball could do that. The trajectory took off, it went up, and it went backwards. You can ask Jeff this. When he comes here in November, ask him. The ball went up, backwards, like a boomerang. It went behind us, and it landed in the car park. Behind us. Jeff's never let me forget this. It sounded like it could have done some damage. So I'm standing there mortified. So the next group waiting to play behind us are doubled up laughing. So I just stood there. Jeff just, his face is blood red. So I put the club back in, and I started to walk to go and find the ball. And Jeff then said an amazing thing. He said, John, don't bother. Just let it go. And then he told me, he said, take a mulligan. So I said, what's that? He said, no, he said, you don't have to play an unplayable ball. I said, really? He said, you don't even have to count it. We won't even write it down. It won't appear on a scorecard. It'll be as though it never happened. Oh, right. I said, okay. So I was given a clean slate, and you begin, and I could start over. A mulligan is a kind of grace note. It was like just a blank sheet of paper. And I started thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have mulligans in other areas of your life? So imagine you're going down Aintree Lane and a police officer stops you for speeding, like you're doing 60 in a 30 zone, and he gives you a ticket and you say, thanks, officer, I'll be taking my mulligan now. And he says, you are, sir. And he rips off your ticket. The bank tells you your check bounced. Mulligan, no problem, sir. And they rip off the account. In an argument with a friend, you know, you say something you shouldn't do. Mulligan. You know, you botch a job, fail an exam, you invest in the wrong company, forget to send in your tax return. Just take a mulligan. No questions asked. No penalty to pay. Wouldn't it be great if you could do that? Because the truth is, folks, people like you and people like me, we need mulligans all of the time. I do. You know, we have a chance to serve someone, but we end up promoting ourselves. We allow deceptive statements to stand because it makes someone else look bad. We blow up for no reason. Sometimes the need for the mulligan runs deeper. Sometimes we need a mulligan for whole areas of our life. Like a woman, I know, she's had a complicated conflict-filled relationship with her mother. She loved her mother in her own way, but she was angry at her all of her life. And the woman's response wasn't to try and sort it out with her mother. She just withdrew. She broke off contact. Finally, her mum died, and now this woman I know is filled with deep regret. She'd give anything for a mulligan to put it right. Or you take a course of action, you make a choice that wounds somebody close to you, and now you're eaten up with guilt, and you'd give anything to have a mulligan. Or you're involved in a dishonest financial practice, and now you live in fear of being found out, disgraced. You live in awareness that your whole life has been built on a lie. I know a man who's a Christian, whose whole life is built on a tissue of lies. And if he gets found out, his whole life will come crashing down. I've spoken to him about it many times, but he persists in his pattern of behavior. If he gets found out, trust me, his life will be a complete disaster. He comes occasionally into my office, and I say, just tell the truth. But he persists in this pattern of deceit. And I say, one day this will all get exposed, you know, in this life or the next. But he persists in it. And it's like a spiritual cancer eating away at his soul. And we all have areas of our life where we just need these mulligans. We need these moments with God where God says, let's set it right. Let's have an hour where we can start again. Or you fail at something that really matters, your marriage, your parents, and your business. And that sense of failure, it just clings to you like a cloak that you can't let go of. It's like your skin. And you lie in bed of a night. You ever been there? You think, if only I could start again. If only I could have an hour that would change my life. You ever felt like that? Many of us have. And I want to say this one. If there's one way that human beings consistently underestimates God's love, it's perhaps in that God's loving, desperate loving, and desperate desire to forgive us. Humanity struggles to believe that God will forgive them. They just do. They struggle to believe that God could possibly forgive me. They believe he can forgive anyone else, but not me. But in John's Gospel, chapter 21, I'd advise you to read this before Easter. You want to read it. You there find a man who failed his best friend, who denied his master, and thought that his failure to put him way beyond God's grace. And it turned out that he happened to be wrong. It's a story of hope for anyone who's been broken by failure. Story of hope for you and me. It's a story of man's failure and God's forgiveness. John 21, read it. It's a story of man who threw away the chance of a lifetime. It's a story of a man who found the Lord at the second chance. Friends, you need a second chance. And so do I. Story begins at 6 o'clock in the morning on Lake Galilee. And Peter and his friends have been up all night fishing. And they've caught nothing. Not a single fish. And fish mattered. It was their business. It was their livelihood. And a figure is on the shore. They can't quite make him out. And he calls to them, and it's a voice they've heard before, but they don't recognize him. And the voice says these words. He says, children, you haven't caught anything, have you? Fantastic voice. They've been up all night toiling away. It's hard work on Galilee. And it says, children, you haven't caught anything, have you? He doesn't say, have you caught anything? He makes a statement. I love this. You haven't caught anything, have you? And the question has a little sting in it. And it's designed to see if they'll accept reality. Failure. And Jesus often uses little statements like that, questions, to see if people will acknowledge the truth about themselves. That's the starting point for the changed life. You understand that? It's very clever, Jesus. What were we talking about along the way, he once asked them, when they were arguing about who was the greatest? That's a really funny story. God's like 6 foot ahead of them on the path. The God who made them, the God who's walked on water, raises the dead, and they're 6 foot behind saying, well, I'm going to sit on his right-hand side. I don't know about you people, you know. And he's listening. What were you talking about? And then they put their heads down. Well, not much really, Master, you know. Who's got a coupe de tea? Who's going down to Tesco's? Who's got the money? What were you talking about? He asked the woman, where's your husband? Well, she's been married 5 times. How's he going? He asked the fisherman. Catch anything? And he softens his sting a little bit, but he says, children, the only time he ever addressed these disciples with that word, the only time in the whole of his life, children, he says, by what we would say, well, boys, any luck? And a remarkable thing happens. A group of fishermen admit they haven't caught anything. Now, I used to be a fisherman. Fishermen generally are not known for truth-telling. I used to be a fisherman for many years. Me and my dad would go fishing. And we'd come home, And my mum would say, my mum never could understand why we'd go fishing. We'd be up like at 3 a.m. to go fishing to the canal or Ainsdale mostly. But this was before our church going days. Actually, it was during our church going days. And my mum would say, you know, well, fellas, did you catch anything? No, but you should have seen the one that got away. You know, we never once admitted we didn't catch anything. Did he catch anything? They say no. And they're probably thinking, what's your point? So the story starts with an admission of failure. And that's all Jesus is waiting to hear. Shall I tell you this morning? The Jesus I have followed for near 50 years, all he wants to hear from you is, are you willing to admit the truth? Because he knows anyway. Why would you not tell him the truth that he knows? And the voice says, just put down your nets on the right-hand side of the boat. Don't give up. Just give another try. So they do. Now, soon the nets are so full, they can't lift the back of the boat. And suddenly they realize who the voice belongs to. It's Jesus. And Peter's so full of emotion. Just join with me for the few moments in the story. He recalls the first time he met Jesus, like the story. Jesus got into Peter's boat. He teaches the crowd. Then says to Peter, put your net down to the deep water. And Peter says, oh, we fished all night. We're not going to catch anything this time of day. You know, you're a rabbi. I'm a fisherman. What do you know about catching fish anyway? This is what he's thinking. And Peter says, oh, well, just to humor you. So they do, and then the nets are full to overflow. And Peter says, go away from me. I'm a sinful man. I've prayed that sometimes. Haven't you? I've prayed that sometimes. But Jesus says, I know all about you being a sinful man, Peter. But I've got plans to help you with that problem. I want to give you a new life. You're going to fish for men. So Peter met the Lord at a second chance. And so now it's after the crucifixion and resurrection, after another fishing miracle, Peter realizes who the voice on the shore belongs to. He throws off his cloak, jumps in the water, and he wades to shore. And then he meets Jesus, who's fixing breakfast. I like Jesus because he does normal stuff, don't you? We just think he floats around and just is always raising the dead, but he does normal stuff. He gives us a baby whose smile lights up my life. You just think it's just a baby. Look at the baby when it smiles. And he's fixing breakfast. He's got a fire going. And Peter gets to the shore while the other guys are bringing in the boat and the net. And in the book of John, the Gospel of John, it includes a little detail. It says Jesus had a charcoal fire going. It wasn't wood. It was charcoal. And there's a reason for this. Because in John 18, when Peter denied Jesus, it was around a charcoal fire. The only two times in the Bible the word charcoal is mentioned. And Peter stands there soaking wet. And Jesus is just, you know, kneeling down. He's poking a fire. And he's got breakfast ready. And Peter gazes into this charcoal fire. And suddenly he's not on the beach anymore. Now he's back in the temple courtyard back by Caiaphas' house. And he remembers it was around a charcoal fire. I denied this man. I denied this rabbi. In fact, I swore. I used bad language in denying him. And his mind now goes back to those moments when he denied he even knew Jesus. And he realizes he's got to face the truth of what he did. And shall I tell you, if you're going to receive help from Jesus, the Lord, at a second chance, you've got to acknowledge the truth about your condition. And that acknowledgement doesn't mean coming to church every week. That's grace. It means acknowledging that without Jesus' help, you're never going to make it to heaven. You can't fix your life. The gospel is good news because Jesus came to put you right with his Father. It's that simple, but that profound. And Peter stands there realizing, I can't put myself right. I can't fix what I got wrong. I so badly let this man down, this rabbi who showed nothing but love. I can't fix it. You have to face up to reality. You've got to take off the mask. A man was desperate for a job, so he applied to a local zoo. And in his interview, the warden applied, said to him, "The gorilla's died. We can't afford a new one, so we'll pay you to dress up like one." Well, he's not too sure, but he needs the money, so he agrees. Each day before the zoo opens, he puts on a gorilla suit and he goes into the cage. And each day he gets a little more enthusiastic about the job. One day he's swinging on the vine so hard, he swings right over the top of the cage and lands right in the middle of the lion's enclosure. A giant lion is 2 foot away and he feels the lion's hot breath on his face. He forgets his disguise and begins to scream for help, at which point the lion says, "Shut up, you idiot, or we'll both lose our jobs." You know, wearing masks can become a way of life. My friend wears a mask. And he tells a lie about his life, and who he is publicly is not who he is privately. And he'll get found out. He will get found out. And the consequences will be terrible. But if he took the mask off, it would be easier to deal with. A wearing mask can become a way of life. Pretend to be happy when you carry a secret ache. Pretending to be spiritually healthy when there's a great distance between you and God. Going to church each week and smiling when inside your heart is aching and breaking. We can all put masks on. And Peter now stands and remembers the great failure of his life around that charcoal fire in the priest's courtyard. He's had lots of failures. When he sank in the water, when Jesus said he was speaking the words of Satan, when he cut the priest's servant's ear off. But this was the great failure. And so he remembered when he stood by that charcoal fire and he failed God. Total failure. And breakfast is now over and he's just standing there alone with Jesus. The other guys are off sorting the fish out. And it's just Peter and Jesus together. Imagine this for a moment before we finish. Jesus is still kneeling down. It's just Peter and Jesus. Maybe for the first time since the crucifixion and resurrection, they're alone together. And Peter's so very vulnerable, this big, tough fisherman who ran away, who denied Jesus. And he's waiting for Jesus to say something. Waiting to hear Jesus' verdict on his life. He can't look at Jesus. He just can't look him in the eye. So he stares at the embers of the charcoal. And then he hears the words that will wound him to the depths of his heart. And yet the words that would heal him and bring him back to life. The words that he would carry to the grave. And Jesus just says, "Do you love me? Do you love me?" Jesus doesn't say, "Peter, you're sorry for what he did." Doesn't say, "Do you promise never to fail? Would you try harder?" No, first things first. Do you love me? It's the question he's asking you this morning. Such a tender question, isn't it? When you ask this question, your heart is on the line. You ask somebody, do you love me? Your heart's on the line, isn't it? Really? It's the question of a hopeful lover. It's the question of a parent to a runaway child. Do you love me? And it's Jesus' question. It's not an easy question, a comfortable question. Sometimes I think about Jesus and his love for me and the cross and the life he's given me and the blessings. And I ask myself that question every day. How much do I love him? Do you love me? Well, I know I love him. But I wonder sometimes, do I love him enough? And Jesus says these words, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He doesn't even use his old informal name, Peter. You notice that? Jesus doesn't presume that Peter wants the old relationship back. Simon, son of John, do you love me? And now Jesus is the vulnerable one. not Peter. Jesus is the lover waiting to hear, does Peter love him? Yes, Lord, Peter answers. But he doesn't fully trust his ability to assess his own heart. He says, you know everything. And I can understand Peter's answers. Lord, you know, as best I know, Lord, I say sometimes to Jesus, you know, I love you. When I'm in my right mind, I want to do better than I am now. Don't you say that? But I don't know the whole truth about my heart, Lord. Only you know. Then feed my sheep, says Jesus. Love them and teach them. Guard and guide and serve my little flock. They mean the world to me, says Jesus. Get back in the game. And three times this is repeated until Peter is deeply, deeply hurt. And why does Jesus keep asking? Three times he says, do you love me? And Peter doesn't know what we know, that he's being healed by the Lord of the second chance. Not once, but three times Peter stood by the charcoal fire and denied his Lord. Not once, but three times he stood by the fire and professed his love for Jesus. And Jesus says to Peter, says to you and to me, to everyone who stood by the fire, because I've stood by the fire and failed, God. He says to you and to me, okay, I'll get back in the game. It's not over. Nurture the gifts I gave you. Cherish the call I gave you. Devote yourself to the church. Feed the church. I want you back. I sliced another ball, this time into the River Alt. And Jeff said the same thing. John, take another mulligan. I said, are you sure? He said, of course, I do it all the time. Now, at this point, on Kirby Golf Course, I got a little concerned about the integrity of the game. Because if you just keep on taking mulligans, then the game doesn't mean anything, especially if, like me, you hit a lot of bad shots. I used 4 mulligans on the first hole. And the reason Jeff was so liberal with our mulligans is because on that day, it didn't matter. It was just for fun. But when the game counts, it's a different story. Because when the game counts, there must be justice. For instance, if you're playing Tiger Woods on the Masters, imagine I'm playing Tiger Woods on the Masters and you're tied on the final hole. I know it's a stretch, but try and use your imagination. So, and we're in Augusta and we're both on the final hole and I slice my drive into the car park. I can't say, excuse me, Tiger, I'll take a mulligan here. There are no mulligans on the PGA Tour. The integrity of the game counts. The rules matter. This is the real thing. You play the ball where it lies, hit the water, you pay the penalty, you reap what you sow. The score is a brutally honest reflection of what you did. You understand what I'm saying this morning? Life matters. Life matters. The rules count. And if God is any kind of God, he must be just. He can't just say, Hitler, take a mulligan. Idi Amin, take a mulligan. Saddam Hussein, take a mulligan. We won't count the Holocaust. We'll just pretend it never happened. Someone must keep score if there's to be justice in this world. Some must keep account of Auschwitz and Tiananmen Square, Kosovo, Dunblane, Omar, the murders, the abused children, the oppressed poor of the world. There must be justice for this world to make sense. And the Bible says that one day justice will roll like a river. Someone is keeping an account of this world. So when someone does something awful and then say, for instance, takes their own life or dies, and you look at the telling, you get so frustrated and think they've got away with it. Let me tell you, they have not. They will stand before Almighty God and give an account for that. There will one day be justice. We will all sign the scorecard. At Bible college many years ago, there was a family with a young boy named Stephen Graham. He was 7 years old and he followed me everywhere. We sat together at meal times. We sat together on Wednesday mornings in chapel. And some Wednesdays he'd pretend to be sick and miss school. Partly my fault. Then at 9:30, he'd get a miraculous recovery and he'd come with me on work party. And he'd spend the morning with me doing all kinds of practical work. Graham was like Jimmy Cagney, an angel with a dirty face. He was just fantastic. One Wednesday morning, I was building a wall, a day like today, and Graham was with me. It was a lovely morning. He was mixing a cement, and we were both ecstatically happy with life. When I was on a technical bit of the wall, about 10 foot up, Graham was watching. Then he got bored, so he picked up a lump hour, and he proceeded to atomize every spider that God had made. So I said, put the hammer down, Graham. Someone's going to get hit. Probably me. Well, Graham didn't listen, and he swung the hammer around his head like in the Highland Games. He let go of the hammer. It sailed over the wall. It went right through a pane of glass in the greenhouse. The crash was unbelievable. I was mortified because I didn't get on with the bursar. It's not Irish, you know. I didn't get on with the bursar. Well, Graham looked at me. Before I could speak, he opened his arms wide and he said, John, I love you this much. Well, what could I do? He was just 7 years old. I had him thrown in jail. So I forgave him, but of course someone, me, I had to pay for the window. You see, forgiving someone isn't just a matter of words. There's always a cost attached. Someone has to pay the debt. And that's what happened at the cross 2,000 years ago. The Bible says in some way we will never fully understand an unpayable debt was paid. We can start over. Thank God. You must start over. This is not sufficient. Going to church all of your life is not sufficient. Feeding the poor is not sufficient. You have to come to the cross of Jesus Christ and let him forgive you and start again. So the first question is not how much do you love God this morning. The first question is how much does God love you? God filled our world with beauty and mystery, butterflies and oceans, sunsets, eagles, rainbows, and Kit Kat chocolate bars. And God didn't say, I love you this much. God gave you a mind and intellect and ability to know right from wrong, to choose good, to choose life. And God didn't say, I just don't just love you this much. God gave you people, family, friends, teachers, nurses, policemen, children, people with whom to know the joy of companionship, of intimacy. And God didn't say, I didn't just love you this much. Then God gave you Jesus. And Jesus was God's ultimate attempt to let us know just how much we mean to him. He was led to the cross to pay the debt we couldn't. He was led to the cross. And God said, now you can be free from the guilt, free from every regret, every demand of justice satisfied. Now you can understand the place you have in my heart. Jesus was led to the cross with his arms stretched wide open, and Jesus said, I love you this much, Danny, and Brian, and Myra, and Ed, and Joel, and Bob, and Marco. I love you this much. And now it was Peter's turn to learn that the Lord of the cross is the Lord of the second chance. Simon, do you love me? Yes, Lord. Simon, do you love me? Yes, Lord. And then he looks at the charcoal fire, remembers his failure. Simon, do you love me? And Simon, with tears in his eyes, says, yes, Lord, I know. Yes, I do. I love you. And Jesus held out his scarred hands. And he said, Peter, this is how much I love you. Let's start again. It's not over. It's just beginning. This friendship we have, Peter, it will never end. And God's church is a place for people who need to start again, people like you and me. People who need redeeming and forgiving of God's passion. He's the finder of directionally challenged sheep, the searcher of missing coins, the embracer of foolish prodigal children, people like you, people like me, people who need an hour to change their life forever. His love has no limits, his grace has no measure, his power has no boundaries known unto men. That's Jesus Christ. And he's in this place. An hour to change your life. Friends, in this hour, you can have your old eternity changed. Two years. And Peter gets to start again. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
I'll tell you even something even better. You can start again. You here today, you listening on a website, you listen on the CD, you can start again. Why would you not? You tell me why you would not want to give your life to someone who can promise you a better life in this life and an endless life with him. Why would you not? Give me a good reason. And Peter gets to start again. And I imagine, this isn't in the Bible, but I imagine as I finish, Peter with tears in his eyes gets forgiven by God, knows he's forgiven, knows he gets to start again. And then stands there with shuffling feet. The other fellas are fiddling with the fish and the nets and the boats. Now doesn't know what to say. And I imagine Peter's thinking, yeah, hallelujah, I get to start again. He's forgiven me. He really has come back from the dead. And I think at this moment, Peter thinks, but is he still the same Jesus? I honestly do think he thought, is he still the same? And Jesus is poking the fire. And Peter says, well, I'll just go and help the guys with the fish. And Jesus, without looking up, says, okay, Peter. Oh, and by the way, you don't have to count the fish. There's 153 in that net. Amen.